His face looked pale. His eyes were red. He clenched his teeth with desperation. "I'm just about homesick enough to chance it," he said defiantly. Then his mood softened. "It's just about time to harvest the wheat at home. How's Ma gonna manage with me gone? Unless I'm there to help her, they'll likely starve come winter."
"No, they won't, Dave," argued Jeff. "Pa will help her, and so will the other Free State families."
David stopped sniffing, but he didn't seem comforted. At night, the soldiers had lots of time on their hands. The veterans, who had already drawn their pay, gambled it away. There were all kinds of card playing, foot racing, long jumping, and side-hold wrestling. Bill Earl, a corporal in Jeff's company, had a rich tenor voice. He was from Bluemont Central College, a Methodist school at Manhattan. He would sing to the boys whenever they asked him after supper. Once they discovered an open-air revival in progress behind a small sod schoolhouse near the bivouac spot. Most of Jeff's outfit attended, and several of the boys became converted, including all the tough ones. Because of the hard daytime training in the woods and on the prairie, the soldiers never seemed to get enough to eat. They were served bacon, beans, hardtack, and coffee 3 times a day, but soon began to yearn for more variety. One hot night in mid-July, they discovered a large patch of ripe watermelons in an open field. Unfortunately, a soldier stood guard over them. For nearly a week, Jeff's company marched back and forth past the field, their mouths watering. One of the men in Jeff's outfit was Noah Babbitt, a tramp printer from Illinois. He was a tall, droll fellow whose skin was tanned dark as mahogany from his long travels in the open. He had set type in newspaper offices all the way from Illinois to San Antonio, Texas, traveling by foot across Indian Territory. Even the longest marches failed to tire him. He was always soaking his long, gnarled feet in salt water to toughen the skin for the long jaunts. He read everything he could get his hands on.
"Boys, I've got it," Noah said late one hot afternoon after they had been dismissed from maneuvers. "Get ready to eat those watermelons."
"I've been ready for a week," said Jeff, dropping his knapsack and canteen into the sand by his feet. Pulling off his shoes, he lay on his back in the shade, wriggling his bare toes in the cool south breeze.
"How are we going to get past that guard?" asked a private from Lecompton.
Babbitt lowered his voice, looking cautiously around him.
"Tonight, I'll go on guard myself in the melon field. Now one of you can hide in the brush along the fence. I'll roll the melons out to you."
"Yep," frowned Ford Ivy. "But the field's already got a guard. What are you going to do about him?"
Babbitt ignored the remark. He said,
"I've got to have help. Who will volunteer to snake the melons out from under the fence to the timber after I roll them out of the field under the fence? It'll be open moonlight."
Everybody looked at everybody else, but nobody answered.
"How about Jeff?"
somebody proposed.
"Sure, he's just the man.
Jeff's little, they'll never see him."
Jeff rolled suddenly to a sitting position.
"Now wait, boys," he protested. "You can't do this to me. It's against the Articles of War. It's against the Constitution."
But they persuaded him. After dark, they all walked quietly to the melon field. The moon was so bright that Jeff could see the light stripes on the big green melons as they lay amid the vines in the sandy soil. Babbitt advanced on the uniformed guard, climbing boldly over the wooden fence.
"Halt! Who are you? I'm on guard here!"
challenged the sentry, raising his weapon. Babbitt's deep voice answered in demanding tones.
"Whose command do you belong to?"
"To Graham's battery," the man answered.
"That's funny,"
grumbled Babbitt, pretending to be confused.
"Wonder why they need two guards. I'm from McGregor's company. I'm assigned here for guard duty, too." "Well, you watch that end. I'll watch this."
The first guard grunted an assent and moved to the upper end of the field.
Soon Babbitt was rolling several big melons under the fence to Jeff, who transported them, crawling, to the fringe of the nearby woods, where hungry hands reached for them in the dark. Later, they cut and divided the tasty booty, and all went quietly to bed. The incident convinced Jeff that privates were as capable of strategy as officers. Next morning, they were told that after one more week of training, they would depart for Missouri. There, General Sterling Price had organized thousands of Missouri state troops into a rebel army. It was reported Price had gone into Arkansas to meet the Confederate general, Ben McCulloch, and urge him to aid the Missouri Confederate cause. Jeff was elated by the news. A short furlough had been granted the volunteers living within 75 miles of the fort. That meant David and Jeff could make a quick trip home to see their families. John Chadwick decided to stay at the fort.
"If I go home, I'll just have another big brawl with Pa over joining up, and he'll whop me," John grumbled.
2 days before the furlough began, Jeff awoke early. He drew in a long, luxurious breath. He liked the pungent early morning smell of the sandbar willows and the tamaracks. He liked to see the White River mist crawling slowly along the surface of the water. He looked at David's bed and felt a vague alarm. David wasn't there. His clothing was gone. His army knapsack and canteen lay on his folded bedding. His rifle, brightly polished, was neatly stacked. Something white was pinned to the bed. It was a torn-off fragment of notebook paper. On it, rudely printed in pencil, was this note. "Jeff, I can't stand it no longer. I have gone home to see Ma, David." Jeff was stunned. How could David leave the army and its excitement, its promise of glorious adventure? Where was he now? As Jeff hurriedly thrust his legs into his pants, he tried to calculate. David would probably travel alone, swimming the river and skirting the fort until he encountered the military road leading south to Linn County. Jeff resolved not to report him. That way they wouldn't miss him until after the morning roll call, and he would have at least 2 hours head start toward home.
"I don't understand why I didn't wait," he told John Chadwick. "We're both going home in 2 more days." "I just don't understand."
Chapter 5. Furlough.
"Jeff!"
His younger sister was the first to see him as he strode wearily into the yard just before sundown. Barefoot, she was sweeping the rock porch. She threw down her straw broom and with a glad shout ran to the house to tell the rest of the family. Then she returned, slamming the door behind her to throw both arms around Jeff's waist and hide her brown head under his arm. Bess and his mother ran out to join the happy homecoming and found Ring leaping and bounding all over Jeff. The big gray dog was so glad to see his young master that he grasped a cottonwood stick in his mouth and, whining and moaning with pleasure, ran around and around the woodpile with it, scattering the chips and kicking up small clouds of dust. Mary shouted with laughter. Emery Bussy hurried up from the barn. Grinning, he held out his hand. They sat up that night until 9 o'clock while Jeff told them all about his new life in the army. To Jeff's surprise, his father remembered Clardy from the Mexican War.
"He had the makings of a good officer, but he was a strange, vindictive fella whom nobody trusted," Emery recalled. "He turned very bitter when his own regiment, the Mississippi Volunteer Rifles, elected Jeff Davis colonel. Clardy wanted the job. He had set his heart on it. When they elected Davis, Clardy left the regiment and moved away from the South forever."
Jeff leaned forward, listening carefully. So that was why Clardy hated the mention of anything Southern. The family had more news for him. David Gardner wasn't home. Jeff's heart missed a tick when he heard that. Had David drowned trying to swim back across the wide Missouri? Had he been captured by the soldiers or murdered by the bushwhackers? For supper that night, Jeff's mother fried wheat biscuits in a pan and roasted sweet potatoes in the fireplace ashes. Best of all, she baked a delicious green grape cobbler in her fireplace oven. For breakfast next morning, they had sweet toast, home-baked wheat bread toasted in a pan over the fireplace coals. There was hot milk to cover it, and butter, salt, and sugar to add for taste.
"Mama, the Army hasn't got any cooks near as good as you," Jeff told her loyally between gulps.
She looked anxiously at him.
"I don't see how you can tell you're eating too fast to taste the food,"
Jeff said.
"I'm tasting it when it goes down."
His brief leave of one day and two nights at home passed all too quickly. He spent the morning helping his father thresh the wheat by hand, using two hickory clubs tied together with buckskin and letting the wind blow out the chaff. Early in the afternoon, he helped Bess pack the eggs and bran so they'd be ready to take to the trading post. He went to the spring house with Mary and helped her skim the cream off the cool milk and churn the butter. He helped his mother plait lamp wicks and fry refuse pork, out of which to make the fuel oil for the lamps. Although all four of them were putting up a great show of being brave, Jeff couldn't help noticing how they kept stealing pensive sidelong glances at him, as though they didn't want to forget what he looked like. He wished he had thought to have a daguerreotype made at the gallery in Leavenworth so he could give it to them. Neither he nor Bess nor Mary had ever had their pictures made. Just before bedtime, Jeff took a short walk outdoors with Ring. He looked thoughtfully at each well-known object as it lay sleeping in the bright Kansas moonlight. The little creek where he had trapped skunk and muskrat, his duck blind on the river bank, the big oak tree where he had twisted the rabbit out with a forked stick. Now they seemed unimportant and far away, like a child's toys. A coyote's melancholy wail floated in from across the river. Jeff saw the hair rise on Ring's back. The big dog growled deep in his tawny throat, then whined and looked inquiringly at Jeff. But Jeff just reached down and patted him, then turned back toward the house. There wasn't time for a hunt now. Next morning at sunup, he was back on the military road, headed for Fort Leavenworth. As he passed John Chadwick's place, he saw gray smoke curling from the chimney. Old man Chadwick and one of his boys were yoking the oxen to the tar-hubbed wagon, probably getting ready to go to the trading post, Jeff thought. He stopped a minute to tell them how John was getting along. John's mother was anxious for news and gave Jeff a big drink of cold clabber milk. But the rest of the family seemed to regard him coldly, as though he had persuaded John to join up. He was glad to be back on the road again. Then the road became rockier, and the soil lighter and thinner. He was approaching the Gardner place. The brown corn had made a fair stand and was nodding in the warm wind. But the rows were so crooked, you could tell that a woman had done the planting. Jeff glanced at the mean one-room log house and thought he heard voices. Then he stopped in surprise. David and his mother were standing in the yard. Mrs. Gardner looked tired. Apparently her faded blue sunbonnet failed to protect her plain, florid face from the sun. Like David and all the rest of her homely brood, she was red-haired, with splashes of orange freckles running over her face, neck, and arms. Glad that David was home safely, Jeff ran beneath the trees toward the house. As he came closer, he saw that David's face was dirty and tear-begrimed, and his clothing torn as though he'd been living in the brush. Apparently, he had just arrived. Mrs. Gardner was looking fiercely determined. Her red face was flushed, her mouth a tight line. Two of her children stood behind her, listening with curious concentration. Bobby was playing in the mud by the horse trough. Nobody paid any attention to Jeff. Mrs. Gardner said to David,
"You walked 60 miles away from me to enlist, and now you come crawling back to me that you're tired of it and that you want to come back home. Well, it's too late now to come back home. You're in the Army. That's what you always wanted, so go on back to the Army."
David's blonde brows wrinkled with anger.
"I won't go back," he almost screamed. "I'll go up into the hills and live before I go back to the fort again."
His mother put her hands on her hips and stared at him with disgust.
"You'll go up into the hills," she mimicked him scornfully. "You couldn't live a week by yourself up there. You'd starve or you'd get homesick. Or somebody would turn you in as a deserter just to make the $30 the government would pay to anybody turning you in. Or the bushwhackers would find you and kill you like a dog."
David sniffed and wiped his red eyes with the knuckles of both his dirty hands. His manner changed from defiance to pleading.
"Please let me stay here, Ma," he begged. "I don't want to go to war. I get too homesick."
She shook her head and pointed to the road.
"If you're brave enough to leave us and run off and join the army, then you're brave enough to go on back to the army. There's the road. Take it."
The wretched boy looked at her incredulously, then broke into a fresh torrent of tears.
"Here again, me ma," he bawled bitterly. "I never thought my own ma'd go agin me like that."
Jeff felt sorry for David, felt sorry for them all. But he was glad to see that David had somehow reached home safely. He walked slowly up to them, feeling embarrassed to interrupt.
"Howdy, Dave," he said. "Howdy, Ms. Gardner."
Both of them looked at him, but neither spoke. Jeff walked a step closer.
"You can go back with me, David," he offered. "I'm on my way to Leavenworth now. If you come back with me, they might let you off light. I'll sure talk to them about it. Pretty soon the lonesomeness will all wear off, and then you'll like it in the army, David. I know."
David looked once at Jeff, then at his mother.
"I guess I'll have to go with you, Jeff,"
he said brokenly, his voice still rough with anger.
"Nothing else I can do."
Again he looked accusingly at his mother. Calmly, but firmly, she met his look and conquered it.
"Better go down to the creek, Davy, and wash yourself," she said, her voice softer, but still stern. "Then you can come to the house if you want. It's a long walk to the fort. You'll need a fresh change of clothes. I'll cook you some breakfast and pack you a lunch for the trip."
Obediently, David turned and trudged off dejectedly toward the creek. For a moment, a look of tender compassion crossed her face. He was her own flesh and blood, the only man she had left in the world. Jeff swallowed as he watched her. He knew how hard it must be for her to send David back to the war. But Kate Gardner never hesitated. Chin up, she walked with a firm stride back into the house and began rattling the pots and pans. While David washed and ate in silence, Jeff dropped his bundle and pitched into the gardener chores. He finished milking the cow and toted the filled pails to the spring house. He turned the cow out and cleaned her stall with a pitchfork, scattering fresh straw on the hard dirt floor. Half an hour later, he and David were again on the road. This time, there was little talk between them. Chapter 6 March. A week later, they broke camp and began the long battle march from Fort Leavenworth to Springfield, Missouri. The bugles blew at 3 o'clock in the morning. Jeff didn't hear them, but when the orderly sergeant shook him, he got right up, washed his eyes in cold water, and began to pack. Tents were pulled down and rolled up, and, with mess boxes and camp kettles, packed into the baggage wagons. Mules were fed and harnessed, horses saddled, cannon and ammunition trucks backed into line. Soldiers hurried to the creek, filling their canteens with fresh water.
"Fall in!"
barked Milholland, the sergeant, pointing with his arm to indicate the right of the line. Shortest man in his squad, Jeff went automatically to the left end of the line. He had learned long ago that the tall men always took their places on the right and the short ones on the left, so it was easier for each to find his place.
"Count off! Remember your numbers! Don't swap places!"
The night was black and still. A cloud bank was rising in the west, and when fiery threads of lightning veined suddenly across it, Jeff saw them reflect dimly off the cannon, some of the guns showing black, others brassy bright. Behind him, the artillery gun drivers had their teams hitched and were standing patiently at attention, ready to mount at the word. Jeff felt a flush of excitement. Unlike the bivouac in the Missouri River bottoms, this was the real thing. At Grand River, the Kansas Volunteers were to join General Nathaniel Lyon. Their combined force of a little more than 5,000 men was the only federal command between Rolla and the new state of Kansas, representing the forlorn hopes of all the Union people in that vast area. Jeff knew very well what was at stake. Lyon was hurrying to Springfield to meet the rebel armies of Price and McCulloch. If the southern force of 10,000 men won a decisive victory, Missouri would fall to them, with its rich middle portion from which valuable supplies could be had and thousands of men recruited for the rebel cause. Jeff felt a grim satisfaction. It seemed good to be moving aggressively into Missouri for a change, instead of always waiting for the bushwhackers to come across the border and hit them first. But for half an hour, the infantry stood in line, waiting. Impatient, Jeff twisted and squirmed in his tracks.
Corn! What were they waiting for?
He would explode if there was further delay. Daylight came finally, and the eastern sky was laced with pearl and orange. The cloud bank in the west was receding. The wind blew up softly from the south, carrying upon it the musty odors of the creek bottoms. Jeff could feel its cool flush on his face and see it gently bend the buckbrush and the prairie grass close by. But still, the column didn't move. Suddenly, he heard a cavalry bugle blowing, "Prepare to mount." It wouldn't be long now. He saw each trooper grasp his reins in his left hand and put one boot in the stirrup. At the bugle's single toot ordering mount, they all swung into the saddle as one, their rumps slapping the leather seats almost in unison. A dapper little lieutenant up front dropped his arm violently downward, and the cavalry moved out in single file. Quickly the infantry received its marching summons too, and amid the muffled tread of thousands of feet, they were off at last. Jeff heard the creak of harness, the jingle of chains, the chucking of cannon wheels, and the pounding of hundreds of hoofs as the horses and mules plunged obediently to obey the shouting, cursing teamsters and the cruel popping of their long black bullwhips. It was fine to be marching in the cool of the morning. As Jeff marched, he squinted suspiciously out of the corner of his eye at Pete Milholland, the big lout of a sergeant who plodded along out of step beside the squad. Milholland was bow-legged and walked with an awkward roll, as if he were following a plow on his dirt farm back in Douglas County. Nothing he wore seemed to fit him. His shirt sleeves were too short, his wafer of a cap perched on the side of his blonde head, and its bill fell almost over one ear. He seldom spoke, preferring to enforce discipline with a stern half-scowl. Despite his inaptitude for military life, the new sergeant was trying to better himself. Each night Jeff saw him laboriously studying a well-thumbed army manual by the light of a campfire. At times he seemed like a fairly decent fella, but he was an officer, and Jeff didn't like officers. Jeff thought it was a great sight to see the army, like a gigantic bull snake, serpentining through the countryside in a long, loosely jointed column a mile in length, the cavalry leading, the infantry in the middle, and the artillery riding behind. His heart beat high. They were leaving the last jumping-off place, going farther and farther away from the security of the fort. Every mile they traveled took them nearer to battle. The sun rose higher and higher in their faces, and the morning grew hotter. Now the exhilaration was gone, and the marching became hard work. Sweat began to drop off the tip of his nose, and he was conscious of black gnats crawling into the hairs on his arms. He plodded steadily forward, his footsteps blending with thousands of others ringing off the hard pike. Grasshopper snapped noisily in zigzag flight, bounced on the hot ground, and were upended in the dust. Cicadas sang from the roadside elms. The heat was so great the trees were losing their leaves. It reminded Jeff of his mother's hens dropping their feathers as they molted. The men began to murmur. One complained he couldn't go a step farther. Milholland wiped the sweat off his nose with his sleeve and gave him a dirty look.
"Sure you can," he growled. "You can always go farther than you think you can. This is pretty hard, but we can stand it."
The sergeant was right. Jeff had learned in his training marches across the Missouri that fatigue is mostly mental. Browned by the Kansas sunshine, his body was wiry and tough. He felt as if he could keep going all day. Every time the column stopped to rest, Milholland reached over and, with a powerful tug of his right hand, helped ease the heavy pack off Jeff's small back. Each soldier was carrying about 40 pounds. His musket, canteen of water, haversack of rations, a 20-pound knapsack, and 40 rounds of ammunition, besides the heavy shoes on his feet and the clothes on his back. Jeff should have been grateful for the assistance. Instead, he felt embarrassed.
"Thank you, sir," he told the sergeant. "I can heft it."
Milholland gave him such a dark, glowering look that from then on he accepted the sergeant's aid in resentful silence.
"Wished I had me a cavalry hoss," John Chadwick said enviously. "Them fly slicers sure got it easy." "Not as easy as the battery men," said Ford Ivy, switching his rifle from his right hand to his left. "Them wagon soldiers always gets to ride."
The back of Ford's blue cotton shirt was stained dark with perspiration. Ivy upped his canteen and took a long pull of the water. His Adam's apple oscillated as he drank.
Tramp, 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 tramp.
Soon the sun was almost directly overhead. The heat was searing. Jeff felt every tissue in his body was being wrung dry. He knew the horses must need water, too, but they hadn't passed a pond or stream for miles.
Tramp, tramp, tramp.
Now their marching footsteps were slower. The sun began to slant westerly behind them and over their right shoulders. They passed a meadowlark sitting on a rail fence, gasping with its bill open. The heat came up through the soles of Jeff's brogans, burning his feet. In the hot south wind, the roadside grass rippled in long waves. Wheels rolled, wagons creaked. Canteens flashed in the burning sunshine as the men drank heavily during the rest stops. They seemed to suffer more from drinking too much water than from lack of it.
"Just take a sip," advised Milholland. "Don't drink too much. It'll make you sick."
But not all the thirsty Kansans accepted his counsel. Three boys in Jeff's company guzzled too deeply and had to drop out and be picked up by the ambulances. It was on the third day of the march that Jeff discovered with surprise how much water a single company could drink.
"Here's water,"
somebody had called. And without waiting for the officers to give the command, the soldiers broke ranks, hurrying through the dusty woods. Carrying little ropes and buckets, they crowded around a farmer's stone well near the road. Jeff got one good drink and filled his canteen, then watched incredulously as his company scooped water so busily that soon all splashing ceased, and all he could hear was their empty buckets scraping the well's rock bottom. It was the first time he had ever seen a well drained in 15 minutes. Refreshed, the crawling column again was put in motion. Jeff noticed that Noah Babbitt, the tramp printer walking next to him, swung along easily and effortlessly and seemed to be standing the heat quite well.
"How come you like to walk so well, Noah? Don't you ever get a hankering to straddle a horse?" he asked.
Babbitt shook his shaggy head.
"Riding makes my head dizzy, and my feet sore. I'd rather walk. I like to touch the earth, eat haws, smell the wheat, and mingle with the quails, blue jays, and woodpeckers in God's great outdoors."
Jeff blinked with surprise. Noah was certainly an odd one.
always pausing to finger and study the leaves of some tree he didn't know, or stooping to inspect some wild flower, or glancing keenly into the bushes at a strange bird. But Jeff liked him. Noah was easy to get along with, and he knew more geography and natural history than all the rest of the company put together.
"What's the farthest you ever walked on one trip?" Jeff asked.
Noah gazed abstractedly at the parched ground passing beneath their feet. Then his white teeth flashed briefly in his tanned, leathery face.
"I guess it was 2 years ago when I hiked from Topeka, Kansas to Galveston, Texas. Why?"
Jeff shrugged. "Oh, no particular reason. I just wondered." They tramped 50 yards more in the broiling sunshine.
"How come you walked clear from Kansas to Galveston?"
Noah turned his somber face seriously toward Jeff.
"You probably won't believe me, youngster, but I wanted to see the magnolias in bloom."
Jeff caught his breath in surprise. Estimating fast, he reckoned it was roughly about 900 miles from Topeka to Galveston. If a fella could stand all that walking, it would take about a month and a half to hoof it down there and another month and a half to hoof it back. 1,800 miles just to see some flowers. Jeff stole another look at Noah.
If anybody would do it, Noah Babbitt would be the man.
Jeff said simply,
"I believe you. Did you get to see them?"
Noah nodded solemnly.
"Sure did. And they was worth every foot of the trip."
At Grand River, Lyon and his 3,000 Missourians and Iowans were waiting for them. Quickly, two columns were formed side by side, and the march resumed. Jeff gazed with interest at his new comrades. The only Missourians he had ever seen were the bushwhackers. He had supposed that everybody in Missouri was for the rebels, but these men were unmistakably Union. They were outfitted much more completely than the Kansas volunteers. Their blue uniforms were newer, and they carried rubber blankets, bayonet scabbards, and Springfield muskets. Their officers were equipped with Colt six-shooting revolvers. The Iowans sang while they marched and wanted to go swimming in every creek they crossed. As they marched along together, one of the Missourians, weighed down by his pack, staggered a little in the torrid heat and nearly dropped his gun. Looking closer, Jeff saw a boy even smaller than himself. He had big blue eyes and a mop of curly black hair.
"Here, I'll help you,"
Jeff offered, reaching for the gun. But the lad refused the assistance, clinging tightly to the weapon.
"Thank you," he mumbled doggedly. "I can make it."
Jeff handed his own gun to Ford Ivy. Stooping, he picked up a handful of dead grass and turned to the boy.
"Give me your cap a minute. I'll show you a way to turn the heat."
Obediently, the lad handed it over. Jeff put the dried grass in the crown, poured water from his canteen over it, and handed it back to its owner. It was a trick he had learned with his own straw hat while plowing. The boy clapped the cap gratefully onto his black curls.
"Thank ye," he said shyly. "That's real cool."
Trudging along, Jeff asked the Missouri boy, "What's your name?"
"Jimmy Lear. What's yours?"
Jeff told him, and they fell to talking. Jimmy was from St. Louis and belonged to Lyon's army. He had walked all the way, except for a short boat ride near Boonville. He told Jeff he had belonged to a military club in St. Louis organized by Frank P. Blair, a leader there of the Unconditional Union men. They had drilled for weeks without guns. When war was declared, they had promptly joined the Union Army. Riding in steamboats, they had already been in a couple of skirmishes at Jefferson City and Boonville, breaking up small concentrations of state troops that were being pointed for service with the rebels. Jeff listened enviously. Nothing so exciting had yet happened to him. They were deep in Missouri now, and Jeff stared with curiosity at everything he saw. Everything here seemed so different from Kansas. The houses were much older, and the country more heavily populated. All afternoon long, Jeff had felt something itching under his arms and in the edge of his hair. He thought it was gnats or heat rash, until after supper when he walked to the persimmon grove where the Missouri troops were camped and hunted up Jimmy Lear.
Instantly, Jimmy clapped his eyes on Jeff's arm. Reaching over, he began to pick several small, gray-looking objects off Jeff's skin.
"Look," Jimmy blurted. "You got graybacks."
Jeff's forehead wrinkled in puzzlement. With a quick motion of his right hand, Jimmy captured another of the tiny insects.
"Boy, you got 'em all right."
"So have you," said Jeff. With thumb and forefinger, he trapped one on Jimmy's forehead. For a moment, the two boys stood toe-to-toe, pulling the insects from each other's skin. Finally, Jeff asked,
"What are graybacks?" "Lice," said Jimmy. "Only we call 'em Arkansas lizards. Looky here. I'll show you how to make 'em kill each other."
He put two of the small insects together on a piece of white cartridge paper, and they began fighting fiercely.
"Corn," marveled Jeff. "Watch 'em go after each other, just like hogs fighting."
Later that evening, both boys stripped, and Jimmy showed Jeff how to shake his clothing over the campfire. When the lice dropped into the flames, they popped like salt. But the soldiers never seemed to be entirely rid of them. Day after day they marched, usually covering 20 to 25 miles from morning to dusk. The more they marched, the more they got used to it. Now the heat didn't bother them so much. The flat land began to give way to hillier country, and they encountered more streams and saw more trees, mostly hickory and oak and persimmon. Each night they tried to camp beside a small river, and when everybody but the mess cook stripped off and went swimming, the stream would be so full of naked men that Jeff couldn't see the water. As they dressed, he could smell the smoke from the campfires and hear the hiss of the bacon frying. One night, Jeff wrote to his parents, "We eat breakfast early and supper late to lose the flies. But at noon, the flies get as much of it as we do." He hoped to mail the letter when they reached Springfield. The government stage would take it back to Fort Leavenworth, and it would go south from there by mule train to Sugar Mound near Jeff's home, where his folks would get it when they came to buy supplies. After the meal, the men usually sat around smoking and resting. Some washed their socks, shirts, and drawers in the river. Others submitted to the shears and razors of the several regimental barbers who traveled with Lyon's army from St. Louis. General Lyon had even brought along a 20-piece regimental band that played each night. Ever since the Missourians had joined them at Grand River, Jeff had watched the perspiring German musicians striding along stoically in the heat, carrying their brass horns on their thick red necks or under their fat muscular arms. One night after supper, Jeff walked over to the Missouri troops' camp to visit Jimmy. He found him shaving under a small persimmon tree. Jimmy had placed a small broken piece of mirror in the crotch of the tree and, straight edge in hand, was peering into it. He'd lathered one side of his face and was scraping it with the razor when a husky sergeant, hairy and pug-nosed, walked up. Standing behind Jimmy, he watched him suspiciously. Jimmy must have seen the sergeant in his mirror because his hand was trembling.
"How old are ye?"
the sergeant asked, stepping around in front of Jimmy and looking at him accusingly. Jimmy's face blanched. He looked sheepish.
16, sir."
"That's a lie," the sergeant snorted. "Likely you're near 13.
He looked shrewdly at Jimmy.
"Why are you shaving at all? There ain't no whiskers on either side of your face. They ain't even any goose down."
With a dirty forefinger, he reached up suddenly and wiped the soap off one side of the boy's face, exposing a cheek as smooth as a girl's. Jimmy stood silent, still holding the open razor. The sergeant growled,
"Come with me. I wish I knew what recruiting officer signed ye. You'd get a court-martial and a dismissal, forfeiting all pay and allowances."
Jimmy's face was tragic. Jeff saw him swallow helplessly and wished there was something he could do. Jimmy found his voice.
"Sir, they won't kick me out of the army for this, will they? I'm 14, but I'm big for my age."
His big blue eyes stared beseechingly at the sergeant. The sergeant said,
"They ought to make ye walk clear back to wherever ye came from."
Still scowling, he marched Jimmy off to see the captain. Jeff was flabbergasted. No wonder Jimmy had trouble standing the long, hard march. Next evening, they camped 25 miles north of Springfield, and Lyon ordered vedettes and guards posted and sent out scouts.
"We're getting close," Milholland told them. "Captain says the rebels are coming up fast from the south. Looks like we're going to have a battle, all right."
Elated, Jeff got up and took his rifle into the woods to clean it and replace the old load with a new one. If there was going to be a fight, he aimed to be ready. Pointing his gun at the sky, he fired it off so he could clean the breech. A sentry came running up, frowning with excitement.
"Did you fire that gun?"
Jeff nodded.
"Did your captain give you permission?"
Jeff stared at him innocently.
"No, sir. I didn't know I needed permission. I just shot it off so I could clean it. When I go hunting in the woods at home and want to clean my gun, I always shoot it off like that. Why? Is it against the rules?"
The sentry raised his own rifle across his chest.
"You're under arrest," he said sternly. "Come with me."
Jeff was taken before Captain Clardy. Clardy stared coldly at him. When he recognized Jeff, the long scar on his left cheek turned livid. For a full moment, his wild green eyes darted over Jeff. His look was like a whip. Feeling it, Jeff writhed uncomfortably.
"Put 'em on all night sentry duty,"
Clardy snarled and turned his back on them. Although he had marched all day in the torrid heat, Jeff walked sentry all night. At 9 o'clock, his eyes began to feel heavy. At 11, he was nodding. At midnight, he was dozing on his feet and went to the cook's mess to get a cup of hot coffee so he could stay awake, helping himself to the pot on the fire. As he stood drinking, he heard the cook snoring loudly as they slept on quilts under the stars. Then he heard a voice calling his name. Jeff went closer and saw Sparrow, the cook, sitting up in his bunk. He reeked of alcohol.
"Bussie, you're a fool,"
Sparrow mumbled thickly.
"Next time he gets rough with you, ask him how the widow Spaulding died. Back at Oswatomie. And where her $800 went."
Jeff's jaw dropped.
"Who are you talking about?"
Sparrow winked at him owlishly.
"Ask him. Who bashed her skull in the night of the storm? I saw him slip up to her house. I was fishing for flatheads and went into her barn to get out of the rain. He better not get rough with me."
Falling back on his bunk, Sparrow began to snore. There was something familiar about the cook's mumbled threat. Jeff remembered his words in the army kitchen back at Leavenworth. "Clardy knows he wouldn't dare talk like that to me. I could tell you something about Asa Clardy that he wouldn't want you nor nobody else to know." Thunderstruck, Jeff walked back to his post. Was Sparrow talking about Clardy? Had there been a murder, or was the cook babbling from a drunken dream? Just thinking about it the rest of the night helped keep him awake. Relieved, at 4 o'clock in the morning, he slept in his uniform a couple of hours before the army started marching again. Noah awakened him 10 minutes before they lined up. Jeff was tired and logy. He just had time to wash his eyes in cold water and swallow some cold bacon and fried potatoes Noah had saved for him when he heard the cavalry bugles. That night, they camped 4 miles north of Springfield. Jeff heard the staccato beat of a drum coming from the Missourians' mess. Suddenly, he saw Jimmy, surrounded by German bandsmen. One was teaching him to beat the various calls. A parade drum hung from a strap around his shoulders. A pair of polished drumsticks was in his hands. When he saw Jeff, he beamed with pleasure.
"General Lyon says I won't have to go home," Jimmy said joyfully. "I'm going to be a drummer. They're going to let me hone the surgical instruments, draw maps, and carry water to the barbers.
When I reach 16, I get to go back into the army.
The next morning, they marched into the edge of Springfield. Laborers in Union blouses were digging earthworks around the town. As one of the workers raised his pick, he looked familiar. With a glad shout, Jeff ran to his side.
David!
David Gardner stared up wearily, despair written all over his freckled boyish face. His clothing was sweaty and dirt begrimed, his hands dirty, calloused, and raw with blisters. A rough-looking guard with a sandy, hawk-wing mustache stepped threateningly in front of Jeff.
"Move on," he commanded. "These is deserters. Captain says nobody's to talk to 'em."
Jeff said,
"He's from my home county over in Kansas. If I could just speak a word to him..."
The guard looked ugly and showed his teeth.
"I don't care if he's your long-lost brother. Move on, or I'll run you in."
Reluctantly, Jeff moved on. As he walked, he sighed with relief. At least David hadn't been shot. When they had got back to Leavenworth from Linn County, Jeff had gone with David to Milholland, explaining that David was returning voluntarily to his outfit. Milholland had promised to pass on that information to the regimental court-martial handling David's case. Apparently, the sergeant had done as he promised. When the army marched into the streets of Springfield, just before noon, the town was in a near panic. It was August 9, 1861. Everybody knew a battle would soon be fought. The whole town seemed frightened. All afternoon, Jeff watched the excitement and the confusion, while the soldiers lay resting on the grass beneath several gigantic oak trees in the shady town square. Merchandise and household goods were being loaded into wagons, ready for flight. People were cooping their chickens, harnessing their teams, calling to their children. Storekeepers and citizens presented food and tobacco lavishly to the soldiers. Everybody was afraid that if the rebels won, they would ravish the town. A merchant's wife gave Jeff 2 pairs of socks and a small sack of apples. Surprised, Jeff stammered his thanks.
"Good luck," the woman said. Then she added, "My, but you're awfully leetle and young-like to be fighting in a war. You ought to be home with your mammy."
After giving Jeff a long, soulful look, she began sniffing and dabbing at her eyes with the bottom of her blue calico apron. Jeff didn't like her pessimism.
"Corn," he told himself disgustedly. "She acts like we're all going to be killed by the rebels. We can take care of ourselves."
General Lyon rode up on a big gray horse and, without dismounting, began to talk to the Kansas volunteers. He was a short, slender, bony man of about 45, with a rough, homely face. A coarse reddish-brown beard ran up past his ears into his thick, sandy hair. He wore a blue uniform with heavy yellow epaulets, concealing his frail shoulders. Jeff knew that he had fought with honor in the Mexican War and against the Indians. The general said,
"Men, we're going to have a battle. We're going to march out and try to hit 'em before they know we're coming. Don't shoot until you are given orders. Wait until they get close. Fire low. Don't aim higher than their knees, and don't get scared. It's no part of a soldier's duty to get scared."
Scared? Who was scared? Jeff felt a gay excitement. His chance to strike a blow for his new state had come at last. He reached toward the left side of his belt, feeling for his bayonet. It was there. His pack was on his back, and his musket was in his hand. He was impatient to get started. The thin, sweet trill of a bugle pealed in the early twilight. A dozen drums began to beat. An officer shouted,
"Forward! March!"
Thousands of feet began to stamp the hard, dusty ground in unison. The soldiers' heads rose and fell as one as they marched 4 abreast at quick step. The long blue column moved southward.
Chapter 7 Battle of Wilson's Creek. General Lyon had decided upon a bold plan of battle. His smaller Union army had no reinforcements. Their provisions were running low. A superior force was in front of them, and General William J. Hardee, with 9,000 more rebels, was reported marching to cut off their communications. Retreat seemed wise. But Lyon didn't propose to retreat and be closely pursued all the way back to St. Louis. Boldly, he decided to attack and hurt the enemy so he could not follow them. His plan was to march secretly at night the 12 miles to where Price's and McCulloch's rebel army was encamped, and strike at daybreak in a surprise onslaught. Lyon, with 3,800 men and two batteries, would hit the rebels from the north. Colonel Franz Siegel, with 1,200 men and one battery, was to fall upon the Confederates from the south. As the infantry swung along briskly, clouds covered the western sky, and Jeff thought he could smell rain in the air. Milholland raised his bearded chin, eyeing the heavens hopefully.
"A rain'd be just right for us," he said. "Might cause 'em to draw in their pickets. If they do, we'll give 'em a real surprise."
"Wonder what them rebels look like," quavered a frightened boy in the ranks.
Jake Lonigan, the grizzled sergeant from Junction City, snorted.
"They wear horns," he croaked. "A common article of diet among 'em is young and tender babies."
As they moved nearer the enemy, there was silence in the ranks. The road grew rockier. Fearing that the enemy could hear them approaching, they stopped to bind the cannon's wheels in blankets and the horses' hoofs in sacks, then resumed the march. Jeff's company, commanded by Clardy, was stationed near the rear. Behind them were the horse-drawn ambulances, their shelves filled with bottles and drugs, and the doctors and medical orderlies with their cases of sharp surgical instruments. The men were solemn, now that the hour of battle approached. Jeff could sense it in their white, wistful faces and hear it in their hushed whispering. They exchanged messages to be delivered to relatives and sweethearts back in Kansas in the event they were killed. Jim Veach, a Westport boy who liked to play cards, tossed his deck into the sumac bushes at the side of the road and grimly resumed his marching. In the dim light, the white faces of the cards settled slowly over one bush, decorating it gaily. Puzzled, Jeff nudged Noah Babbitt, marching next to him.
"Noah, why'd he do that?"
"He probably doesn't want to be killed in battle with playing cards on him," Noah said gravely. "It's a superstition lots of soldiers have. They've been told in church that it's wrong to play cards. They're afraid if they get killed with playing cards on them, they won't go to heaven."
Then Jeff saw Neely North, a breezy recruit from Shawnee Mission, stoop and carefully pick up the cards Veach had thrown away, pocketing them.
"Neely's not so superstitious," Noah explained. "He'll probably sell Veach's cards back to him if they both live through the battle."
If they both live through the battle. Jeff stepped around a limestone outcropping in the dusty road, scoffing inwardly. They had been told back at the fort that very few soldiers were killed in proportion to those who fought. What made everybody so gloomy? War was a lark, an adventure made for men. Swinging blithely along, he felt Noah's steady gray eyes on him.
"How do you feel, youngster?" Noah asked. "Haven't you got scared yet?"
Jeff shook his head. "I've been waiting a long time for this night." The Kansas Volunteers were the worst-dressed troops Jeff had ever seen. The war had just begun, and much of the new equipment hadn't yet arrived from the northern factories. Jeff was wearing the civilian pants and shoes that had been furnished him at the fort, and army drawers, blouse, and socks. On his head was the same hat his mother had plaited from Linn County wheat straw. With a clatter of hoofs, the 6th Kansas Cavalry galloped past on its way to the head of the column. A big, swarthy cavalryman, clad in a black suit, rode with them. He was bareheaded, and his curly chestnut hair was fluttering in the breeze. "That's Rufe Forney of Atchison," Jeff overheard somebody say in the next squad. "He's a corporal in the cavalry. He just got spliced at Leavenworth before we left. Got himself a purty gal, too, the blacksmith's daughter. He's still wearing his wedding suit."
Suddenly, a muffled gunshot, followed by a scream of agony, rang out ahead. The column was thrown temporarily into confusion and slowed to a halt. Captain Clardy came running past from the rear, his sword swinging and bouncing noisily at his side, his stern face dark with displeasure. A medical orderly sprinted close behind him.
"Keep marching, you fools! Nobody ordered you to stop!"
Clardy roared. Then he disappeared up ahead, plunging through the brush as he skirted the column.
"Rout step! Keep marching!"
Milholland barked.
"Hup! Hup! Hup!"
Swallowing hard, Jeff tried to march on tiptoe so he could see better. For the first time, he felt a slight panic. He looked at Noah, then at Milholland, but they were staring stonily ahead as they marched. Soon he heard voices and somebody weeping loudly with pain. Captain Clardy and the medical orderly appeared. Between them limped Walter Van Orstrand, a Douglas County boy from their own company. His weak face twisted with suffering. He was blubbering and sniffing. His left hand was wrapped in a bloody white bandage, which he held tightly clutched in his right hand.
"Captain, I tell you, it was an accident,"
the boy kept pleading and sobbing.
"You're a liar,"
Clardy stormed, his face black with rage.
"You deliberately shot it off so you'd get a discharge. Well, it won't work. I'll have you court-martialed for cowardice. You're yellow as a dandelion."
His rough voice rang with scorn.
"No, Captain, no,"
the boy whimpered piteously.
"Honest, I'm not. My gun just went off while I was marching."
He gave another howl of pain.
"Oh, it hurts awful."
"Shut up, you're sniveling," roared Clardy. "You are carrying the gun over your shoulder. It's a long gun. You couldn't have shot off your finger unless you stuck it over the muzzle. You're just a yellow-bellied coward, that's all."
Their arguing became fainter and fainter as they passed toward the ambulances in the rear. The men began to mutter to one another in low voices as they marched.
"What happened? What happened?" everybody asked, although everybody had a pretty good idea now.
Jake Lonigan grunted, shifting the pack on his back with a single swagger of his powerful shoulders.
"Captain's probably right. The man probably got so scared that he shot off his own finger just to get a discharge. They do it in every war."
"Leave the army? When they were just heading into their first battle?"
Jeff could hardly believe his ears. Jeff looked at Lonigan and sighed. He envied the brawny sergeant who had bulging muscles and weighed 230 pounds. In their training bivouac, Lonigan had shown a perfect mastery of the manual of arms and could throw down any man in the company. In the election of officers, he had been the almost unanimous choice of his squad. The night deepened. The pace slowed. The road wound up and down several small rocky hills covered with timber. Once Jeff saw the dark outline of a log house, although all the windows were dark and no dog barked. He felt thirsty and, without slackening his marching pace, took a drink out of his canteen. The water tasted cool and sweet. It was surprising how well you could see after you got used to the darkness. At 1 o'clock in the morning, by Milholland's big silver watch, they stopped in the roadside grass and rested a couple of hours. Jeff checked the priming and the hammer on his musket, then lay down on the rough ground and slept. At 3 o'clock, he felt a hand shaking his shoulder and heard the sergeant's voice whispering in his ear.
"Fall in and keep silent. We're mighty close to the enemy."
It was cool on the ground. As Jeff got quickly to his feet, he could hear the June bugs droning sleepily from the grass roots. Their song sounded plaintive, almost hushed. Reaching into his pocket, he drew out a small package containing the last of his rations, a strip of cold bacon, some stale corn pone,
and two apples from the sack the lady storekeeper had given him at Springfield. He had given all the other apples away. He was too excited to eat much. A flash of lightning illuminated the scene, and Jeff saw that Zed Tinney, a quiet, religious boy who lived near Waubonsie, was clutching in one hand a small Bible bound in black leather. Fear and despair ruled his face. Resigned to being